Hi, everybody. Welcome to North Coast Chronicles podcast, Tales from the Great Lakes. I'm your host, Helen Prohl. Please join me every month on the American Shoreline Podcast Network, ASPN, as we share the nature, history, folklore, and charm of the Great Lakes, America's fourth seacoast. Be sure to check out the entire collection of podcasts on ASPN related to our oceans, coasts, and inland seas at coastalnewstoday.com. If you like North Coast Chronicles, please share it with your friends and subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I've been so looking forward to this episode called Secrets from Below, the mysterious and fascinating underwater world of Noah's Great Lakes Shipwreck Sanctuaries. Like last month's, we have three fabulous guests. Joining me as my co-host for the show is Rear Admiral Tim Gallaudet. Tim has a long bio. He is former oceanographer of the U.S. Navy, former Assistant Secretary for Oceans and Atmosphere from the Department of Commerce, and former Deputy Administrator of NOAA. He is currently CEO of Ocean STL Consulting, where he serves as a strategic advisor to a wide range of innovative startups in the ocean, weather, climate, environmental, and space sectors, as well as a current host of ASPN's American Blue Economy podcast. Tim, thanks so much for joining North Coast Chronicles as a co-host.
I am so glad to be here, Helen. Thank you.
It was Admiral Gallaudet who suggested our two sanctuary experts, Mr. Russ Green, superintendent of the Wisconsin Shipwreck Coast National Marine Sanctuary. Russ is not just an underwater archaeologist, he is a maritime archaeologist who knows the region very well, as well as spending time with the Monitor National Marine Sanctuary. Welcome, Russ.
Hi, Helen. Good morning, and thanks so much for having us.
And also with us is Ms. Stephanie Gandula. Stephanie is also a maritime archaeologist and the resource protection coordinator for NOAA's Thunder Bay National Marine Sanctuary based in Alpena, Michigan. She has participated in projects around the world, including the Great Lakes, South Pacific, Sweden, Jamaica, and the Arctic, and experience in various archaeological documentation techniques, public interpretation, and cultural resource protection policies. So thank you so much for joining us, Stephanie.
Thank you, Helen. It's a pleasure to be here.
And with us, as always, is our trusty engineer and my talented co-producer, Tyler Buckingham. So, Tyler, March is still Women's History Month, and I want to thank you and Peter Ravella from ASPN for all you do to highlight the women oceanographers, biologists, and coastal managers who make a difference every day. In fact, most of the hosts on ASPN are women, aren't they?
That's true.
Well, thank you for that. And we appreciate all that you do. Our last podcast was about sport fishing and the sport fishing industry in the Great Lakes. We had three great guests who shared their individual experiences through the American Sport Fishing Association with the Great Lakes Fisheries Commission and as an avid salmon and steelhead trout tournament fisher. Tyler, at the end of the show, I asked Dr. Mark Gayden from the Great Lakes Fisheries Commission his perspective on the outlook of fisheries in the Great Lakes, and he was very upbeat. What was your takeaway from the show?
Upbeat as well. I had the pleasure of going out on a commercial fishing operation in Green Bay last spring. It was a cold morning, Helen. But I'll tell you, you know, there are a lot of interesting fisheries in the Great Lakes that I think most people who are not, you know, from that region know about. And this whitefish fishery uses an interesting technique where they actually put poles into the bottom of the bay and the fish swim into like a big funnel net. And that is how they fish them. Point is, I think that the future of Great Lakes fisheries is very bright, and as long as we manage the resource effectively, I see no reason why we won't be eating whitefish well into the future.
Well, we certainly learned that it's a $7 billion industry for the Great Lakes, so hugely important, not just least of which is the memories many of us accumulate just from being with families and friends as we're fishing or being along the Great Lakes. So I thought that was kind of fun. It was the first time really talking about fisheries as a whole, and I clearly think we need to do much more of it. Our September episode of North Coast Chronicles was called Silence from Below, about shipwrecks in the Great Lakes. Mr. Sean Lay from the Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum talked about the work of his organization, and in particular, the thrill of raising the bell of the Edmund Fitzgerald, which sits in the museum at Whitefish Point, Michigan. Mr. Lay also took a moment to highlight the incredible work and investment by NOAA in two shipwreck sanctuaries in the Great Lakes, the Wisconsin Shipwreck Coast National Marine Sanctuary and the Thunder Bay National Marine Sanctuary. So when Rear Admiral Tim Gallaudet suggested we join forces to talk to, as he would say, two of his favorite people from NOAA who happen to be with those sanctuaries, I jumped at the chance. Now, I met Tim Gallaudet when he was a member of the Committee on the Marine Transportation System Subcabinet Board as Oceanographer of the Navy.
But I really got to know Tim and work with him when he was the acting administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, and was chair of that sub-cabinet board. It was a pleasure to work with you, Tim. And I have to say, Tim was and is one of the biggest fans and champions of NOAA that you will ever meet. I recall that he once said every child in the U.S. should just be just as excited about our underwater adventures as those in space, and have the t-shirt to prove it. Admiral, thank you again for being here. NOAA must be admired for the extensive efforts to protect our ocean, coasts, and inland seas. The National Marine Sanctuary Program is one of those programs. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, right, Helen, thank you. The National Marine Sanctuaries Program is one of my favorite at NOAA, and I loved a lot of programs and offices in that agency. It is celebrating its 50th anniversary, and so for five decades, the sanctuary system has been in place and has gradually grown to include 15 different sites that span from the Pacific in American Samoa all the way over to Stellwagen Bank off Boston, up in the Great Lakes that we'll talk about today, and even down to the Florida Keys and the coast of Texas at Flower Garden Banks. And the mission there is to preserve, protect, educate our next generation on our ocean resources, our ocean and coastal resources. And I think it's just a wonderful program. There's a real great diversity across the system. And my favorite part of the system is the people. And I told you that Russ and Stephanie are two of my favorite people. So I'm happy to talk more and hear their insights.
Thank you. There are a lot of great people at NOAA, I have to admit. One of my favorite agencies, by the way. Now, are there just two designated sanctuaries in the Great Lakes?
Well, there are two now, and there is one being in the process of being designated in Lake Ontario, and Russ is very deeply involved with that. And that's another shipwreck sanctuary, and I'm really excited to hear more about that, Russ, but we should probably talk about your sanctuaries first.
The Wisconsin Shipwreck Coast Sanctuary was dedicated relatively recently, I think April of 2021. And that was just, Tim, that was just after you departed NOAA, but surely the NOAA leadership when you were there had a hand in its establishment.
Right. Well, that, as I said, one of my favorite programs. And so the sanctuaries were a top priority for us. And so in the time I was there, we were able to get the process of designation for Wisconsin Shipwreck Sanctuary underway and nearly complete. And it was really just a lot. I spoke with Russ about this and on meetings and a lot of his teammates. And we also were able to expand several sanctuaries. We expanded the Flower Garden Banks off the coast of Texas. And we were able to initiate a really critical effort to restore the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary's coral reefs with a program called Mission Iconic Reefs. Yeah, all just fantastic work. And there's other things going on right now. I'm not the authority, of course, but I know that there's a new designation process off the coast of California for a sanctuary centered around the Chumash Indian Native American tribes. And I believe there's a process underway to convert, for lack of a better word, the Papahana Moakuakea National Marine Monument across the Hawaiian Islands into a National Marine Sanctuary. So a lot of good work underway that we started, and it's continuing, and I'm just so pleased to see it.
Thank you, and thanks for your work with NOAA and honestly before and after. Now, I read that there are about 10,000 shipwrecks in the Great Lakes, with most being in Lake Erie. But I think the ones that fascinate us most are the stories of shipwrecks in the Upper Lakes. So, Russ, I love that the Wisconsin Lake Michigan Sanctuary is known as the Shipwreck Coast. Russ, you're the superintendent of the Wisconsin Shipwreck Coast National Marine Sanctuary. I read that it's home to 36 known shipwrecks. Is that correct?
That's right. Yep. And many more yet to be discovered, maybe a couple of dozen or so.
Well, it's hard to believe that they can't find them. But first of all, like how big is the sanctuary? And for folks who aren't that familiar with Lake Michigan or Wisconsin, where is it located?
So our sanctuary is right in the center of Lake, or the western side of Lake Michigan. So if you're looking at the Great Lakes, we're the lake all the way to the left, the long skinny one goes north to south. That's Lake Michigan. We're on the western shore of that, right about the center of the Wisconsin coastline. So a little bit north of Milwaukee, and we run up almost to the foot of Door County. So that mid-Lake Michigan region of Wisconsin. And as you mentioned, there's 36 historic shipwrecks here. 27 of those are on the National Historic, or the National Register of Historic Places. And so there's a fantastic state underwater archaeology program here in Wisconsin. So we're actually co-managed with the state of Wisconsin. And really part of the impetus, I mean, there's a lot of pieces to sanctuaries, and I know we'll get to those, but this historic piece was so well documented by the Wisconsin Historical Society and the great archaeologists there, that this one just made a ton of sense. And you mentioned communities earlier. There's four communities in our sanctuary that really were drivers for this sanctuary. And again, if you're thinking north to south, at the top is Two Rivers, then Manitowoc, Sheboygan, and Port Washington. So various sizes of those communities, but communities that recognize that, you know, sanctuaries certainly are about protecting and conserving, but they also can be agents and catalysts for economic development, for tourism, recreation. And in our case, our management lane is pretty narrow. It's cultural resources. And we recognize that sanctuary waters are millennia old. There's 12,000 years of human history here in the sanctuary. The resources that kind of are top of mind tend to be shipwrecks. They're so well preserved because of the cold, fresh water. But there's thousands of years of history here. So the communities were so important in seeing this and realizing that the sanctuary too could be a driver for much broader Great Lakes conservation. So we're pretty excited about this big canvas we get to work with.
Are there museums associated with the sanctuary? And Stephanie, you could jump in too, because we talked to the Shipwreck Museum, which is really a museum, right? And they're all about talking and highlighting the shipwrecks, but they don't have a sanctuary per se. So are there museums associated with the Wisconsin Shipwreck Museum, or excuse me, sanctuary?
Yeah, there is. We have a great partner in Manitowoc. That's the Wisconsin Maritime Museum. And they're actually the state repository for maritime artifacts. So they have kind of a state link as well. But that's in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. It's a fantastic facility, a great place to spend a few hours for sure, a half a day. They have the World War II submarine Cobia. Believe it or not, Manitowoc built submarines in World War II and sent them down the Mississippi River. And you can stay on the sub. It's an Airbnb. And so it's a pretty neat story. But yes, there are, that's sort of the, I guess, the biggest one. But in Two Rivers is the Roger Street Fishing Village. Fantastic outdoor displays on the history of fishing in the area. And then further to the south in Port Washington, there's a fantastic 1860s lighthouse. So folks don't have to remember all that. You just have to remember to Google up this mid-coast region and find all these great things there are to do.
Well, especially an Airbnb and a submarine, which I think sounds just fascinating. You have how many? You have 27, you said, on a historic register?
That's right. Yep.
And what makes them different from the other shipwrecks?
You know, the sort of the argument for national, and to be honest with you, you know, if there's 10,000 shipwrecks across all the Great Lakes, you could almost argue national significance for all of those in some way, shape, or form, because they connected, particularly, you know, from, you know, 1800 onward, as Western expansion is happening, the lakes are increasingly connected to the Eastern Seaboard and the rest of the world, really. And so what makes them nationally significant is they contribute to this broad sweep of history. In our case, from the 1830s to about the 1930s, that's what our shipwreck collection kind of represents. But it's just unbridled economic success. I mean, the Great Lakes are an economic engine for North America, and these ships and the people, all different shapes and sizes of ships. So there's the innovation that goes into those, the engineering, there's immigration stories, and there's just really unbridled success as the nation expands westward. We have a really geeky expression in archaeology, and that is we learn about the ones that didn't make it, tell us about the ones that did. So this is just a small snapshot of the thousands of ships that played a role in building the United States.
Well, thank you. That's really lovely. We often talk about shipping in the Great Lakes on the show and, you know, covering early days of building, like when they build the Welland Canal, or even portaging around the Welland Canal, which they did with the Griffin back in the 1600s, which I find just mind-boggling. And then to lighthouses and ships, and even some ships like the Christmas tree ship, the Rouse Simmons that sunk in Lake Michigan. You know, but the story, I think you hit the nail on the head, but the story really behind the shipwrecks in particular, and what keeps us fascinated, is because it's about the people and the people who perished, and the amazing mariners and often passengers who risked their lives on the treacherous waters of the Great Lakes, and the mysteries that still surround so many of them. And I want to get back to some of those fascinating stories. But Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us. You are the Director of Development for the Thunder Bay National Marine Sanctuary. I think of Thunder Bay as the, you know, the port city in northwest Lake Superior in Ontario, Canada. So can you tell us a little bit about, you're obviously a U.S.-based sanctuary. Can you tell us about where you're located and when you were established?
Absolutely. Yes. So we are a little bit smaller than the Thunder Bay, the town name, the city name in Ontario, way up north. We are based around the town of Alpena in northeast Michigan, and the waters that we protect is where the Thunder Bay name comes from. So if you think of, if you're looking at the map of the Great Lakes, and we were talking about Wisconsin Shipwreck Coast on the left, just head over Michigan and head right and east, and you're going to see Lake Huron. And we protect 4,300 square miles of northwestern Lake Huron waters, designated in the year 2000. So we were thrilled to be, or are thrilled to be, the very first national marine sanctuary in freshwater. And very happy to say that since Wisconsin was designated in 2021, we're no longer the only national marine sanctuary in freshwater.
Yeah, that is nice to know. And great to hear a little bit more about the one coming up in Ontario a little bit later that Admiral said Russ was involved in. So how many shipwrecks do you know of in the Thunder Bay Sanctuary?
Well, we just identified or announced the identification of our 100th shipwreck. So these shipwrecks have been known. It's a combination of recent discoveries and vessels that have been known to the local community, the diving community, for years. But we've put eyes on and know about 100 shipwrecks. What's very exciting, similar to Wisconsin Shipwreck Coast, is we know there's many more yet to be discovered out there in Lake Huron. A lot of our work in both lakes is out there mapping, surveying, and looking for those shipwrecks.
You know, the commanding officer of the NOAA charting ship, Thomas Jefferson, was in Lake Erie and Lake Ontario this last summer. And when we spoke with them, of course, we have to ask, did you find anything new, right, when you're out there charting? And the answer is yes. So I find it fascinating that Lake Erie, which is a relatively shallow lake, and obviously lots of recreational boating, and I could see where when they say it has more shipwrecks, that could mean more modern shipwrecks, more modern boats, a yacht or just a fishing boat, adds to that. And it seems like, how can you find anything new? So Russ and Stephanie, I guess starting with Russ, you know, you said you have got a couple of dozen shipwrecks that I guess you know are there, but you haven't found them yet. How can that be with all this amazing advanced technology that you have for searching the bottom of a lake?
Yeah, isn't that incredible? We don't know, and Tim can do a much better job of describing our needs for oceans and Great Lakes mapping than I can, but we don't know a lot about the bottom, in this case of Lake Michigan. Our sanctuary is 962 square miles, and really the charting goes back to, the 1970s or so, and I think it's a hodgepodge. Some pieces are even earlier than that. So, oddly, we don't know a ton about the bottom of Lake Michigan. So many of the shipwrecks here and in Thunder Bay as well were found by wreck hunters. And, just a really deliberate process. They're out there on their own dime, their own fuel. They've got all this emerging technology in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. And so that's how many of these shipwrecks were found. And, you look at the historical record and it says, shipwreck or ship X was, 10 miles west or 10 miles east of such and such lighthouse. And so you start your grid out there, but it's really hit or miss. And so this idea of comprehensive mapping is really important. We were very fortunate this year because we did want to get a better understanding of the sanctuary. It's like managing a place, managing a city without knowing where the sewers and the roads and the electrical systems are. You're kind of flying blind. And the Office of Coast Survey, through some of their own resources, but also a contract, was able to map the entire sanctuary this year. So, that data is still incoming, but we're pretty hopeful that there'll be some new finds in there. And so we'll start to narrow that gap and have a much better understanding of Lake Michigan. To me, the most exciting part of that is we can use that mapping data, that bathymetry data, to begin to construct habitat maps. And that's one of the great values of National Marine Sanctuaries, particularly in the Great Lakes, where we're certainly designated to conserve these amazing cultural resources, but we can direct NOAA's mission into these boxes that we create in the Great Lakes. And this is a really good example of doing that.
Stephanie, do you find the same? I mean, have you had the great fortune of also having the sanctuary fully mapped?
No. We're a little bit jealous that Russ, right out of the gate of designation, got the entire sanctuary mapped. It's very exciting for the entire mapping initiative across the region, which, as Russ was talking about, is super important, and not just for our cultural resources and our cultural heritage, but for habitat mapping and for community managers. There is an initiative called Lakebed 2030 that modeled after Seabed 2030 that is aiming to map in high resolution. So your question about how have we not found all these shipwrecks? How do we not know what's on the lake bottom already with the technology we have is a great question. And I think one that many people have, similar to exploring the deep, deep ocean. And it's really down to, as Russ was talking about, down to that high resolution where we can, we have a general idea of for navigation purposes, but when you want to identify what the lake bottom looks like, what a lake trout is going to be interested in, whether it's cobble or clay bottom, or whether it's a steamer engine you're looking at or a propeller, you need that high resolution mapping data. And both sanctuaries and all of NOAA are a huge part of that initiative to get the lake bed mapped in high resolution for many, many purposes across the Great Lakes by the year 2030.
And Helen, I can talk to this quite well, because what happened is when I was the acting administrator, we were trying to find some big wins for NOAA. And so we thought about what was needed and what would the past administration support. And ocean mapping and exploration was the thing, because we acknowledged, like I did when I spoke with Bob Ballard, the discoverer of Titanic, on a previous episode of my podcast, the American Blue Economy podcast, that much of the ocean is unexplored still. In fact, the U.S. Exclusive Economic Zone at the time, just a few years ago, barely 40% of it had been mapped, and much less of it had ever been characterized with deep diving or remotely operated vehicles and scientific divers like Russ and Stephanie. And so that was our initiative, and I proposed it to the White House's Ocean Policy Committee to have a national strategy to map and explore the U.S. EEZ. And they approved it. So it now exists as something called the National Ocean Mapping, Exploration, and Characterization Strategy and Plan. And there's a council stood up to oversee it, where NOAA is the lead of it. And so there you have it. Not even 40% of the ocean was explored, including the Great Lakes. Now the number is 52%. So we've upped it. But still, that's nearly half of the ocean and Great Lakes EEZs that we don't know anything about, really. And that's why Russ and Stephanie are continuing to discover wrecks, is there's just much of it we don't know. And I've always been harping on the fact that we know more about the surface of Mars and the moon, truly. We've mapped it to higher, both of those to a higher resolution than we have our own ocean and Great Lakes seafloors. And so, yeah, great work, Stephanie and Russ. And I'll one more plug, Helen, pardon me, that when you had Skipper Matt Jaskowski from the Thomas Jefferson on one of your episodes, I love that show, and he talked all about his ship being a part of that effort to map this unknown part of America.
Yeah, it was awfully fun to talk to him, and I was so grateful that he talked to us from the ship from Erie, Pennsylvania, and learned so much about how they operate, and was so excited that they got back to the Great Lakes. I mean, it had been a long time since they got back. And as Russ said, NOAA had to get a contractor to survey his area. So the NOAA ships themselves don't always come in to do that kind of work. So I'm very excited to learn what they learned from Lake Erie and, you know, some secrets that they discovered. And as they mentioned, they need to talk to the state. If they do find a wreck, they need to talk to the state first. And I really respect that. Admiral, thank you so much for your work, because what you did was huge and hugely important. So if anybody says, gee, it only went from, you know, to 52%, you got to understand what you're, you know, how big that is and how much mapping that really entailed, and the commitment of time, energy, and resources and talent it took to bring it to 52%. So, Admiral, I think you and I need to maybe talk to somebody about, you know, trying to get the Thunder Bay Sanctuary fully mapped as well. I'm happy to jump in on that one.
Happy to help. I should also emphasize what Russ had stated, that mapping's important because there's so many reasons for it, both safety of navigation, knowing the bottom so you don't run into it, discovering new maritime heritage resources, shipwrecks, also the habitat mapping for fisheries, and that's a really important scientific endeavor to better manage fisheries. And there's all sorts of really tremendous applications. And so I'm really a big fan of that and glad that that both Stephanie and Russ are supporting it.
Yeah, thank you. Russ, you indicated that you run the sanctuary in a partnership with the state of Michigan. How does that work? I mean, I appreciate that because I'm presuming, right, that the bottom of the lake there is technically owned by the state of Michigan. And so any shipwrecks are owned by them. Could you explain that? And a partnership seems to make sense, but how does that work?
Yeah, you're right. It's all state bottom lands. All the bottom lands, adjacent to the U.S. states, of course, are owned by those respective states. The shipwrecks are owned by the state of Wisconsin or the state of Michigan in the case of Thunder Bay. The Abandoned Shipwreck Act, about the mid-80s, really gave title of abandoned shipwrecks to those wrecks that are in state waters. So, you know, that's kind of the foundation of it. I think for us, the magic part of it is that the sanctuary was seen as extending that amazing program. There's such a rich history of telling stories in Wisconsin through the Wisconsin Historical Society, which is kind of the lead agency with us in managing the sanctuary. There was a state historical society in Wisconsin in 1846, and that's 2 years before we became a state. So they're pretty optimistic about their ability to collect and share stories. So, you know, they really saw the sanctuary as a way to just expand on the incredible work that was being done, not just the archaeology, but also supporting education and recreation and tourism. So it's a really cool fit. And, you know, to be honest with you, the relationship is great. I mean, you have people who are really interested in moving forward, accelerating our knowledge of Lake Michigan and telling those stories and discovering new sites and monitoring the current sites and really linking all of that to the blue economy through diving and paddling and other recreation and tourism endeavors. So, so far, so good. I would say we're a year and a half in. And we're pretty excited about how well this is really working for the sanctuary and the resources.
Stephanie, do you have a similar relationship with Lake Michigan? I'm sorry, the state of Michigan, sorry.
Absolutely. Yes, we are. The sanctuary is co-managed by the state of Michigan. We have the state of Michigan underwater archaeologist right here in our office. In fact, right next door to me, Wayne Lusardi. And it's a necessary partnership and really makes a lot of sense for all those reasons that Russ said. And it's definitely been very productive in keeping those communication lines open between both entities. And then also more opportunity to share sanctuary and state cultural resources, across the basin.
Something also I would love Stephanie to maybe elaborate on is this blue economy success story in the town of Alpena, Michigan, that you and Superintendent Jeff Gray described to me when I visited in 2018. Can you share a little bit about that, Stephanie?
Absolutely, I'd love to. One of our favorite topics really is, of course, the shipwreck stories because they're so engaging and so fascinating. And we've touched on this a little bit, but I think it's really at the core of what we do in sanctuaries, and that's connecting people to these resources, which simply means getting people into their sanctuary. People are going to care about these resources once they've connected with them. And we can go into all sorts of ways that they connect. You don't have to be a scuba diver, but you definitely can scuba dive and technical dive to wrecks over 300 feet deep. But you can also visit these shipwrecks from a glass bottom boat. There's shallow wrecks, 8 feet deep, 15 feet deep that you can paddle to and peer down in that cold, clear water to see a paddle wheeler from 1857. And I'm talking about the connection to lead into that blue economy, because once you have your community that feels connected to this place, this really important place that they take pride in, it leads to a rich educational community. We have an Alpena High School class dedicated to science in the sanctuary. And in fact, as we're doing this taping right now, there are almost 200 elementary school students out in the exhibits at the Great Lakes Maritime Heritage Center here in downtown Alpena. So they're really connecting to their maritime history. So it's become not just a sanctuary here in the town of Alpena, but it's a sanctuary community. And what that leads to, like I said, is that rich educational base that we have here in Alpena that goes from those elementary school kids up to the marine technology program at Alpena Community College, which in partnership with the sanctuary has a marine technology program where these students are going out and working on science research vessels in the Gulf of Mexico, on oil exploration vessels in the Atlantic and the Pacific. So just one connection to the educational, which definitely leads to economic development. But then another one is the people coming in to experience these shipwrecks. You've got local dive shops. You've got, like I said, the glass bottom boat. In fact, the glass bottom boat in the past years has taken out, I think their best year was around 10,000 passengers getting into their sanctuary and seeing those shipwrecks up close and personal. So lots of different ways that the blue economy is really developed here in Alpena and Northeast Michigan.
And you also have Viking Cruise Line starting to make calls. Isn't that right, Stephanie?
Oh, yes. I'm glad you brought that up, because we're right now in the thick of planning for the second season of Viking Expedition coming in to the Great Lakes. In fact, talking about those thousands of numbers for the glass bottom boat, with two different expedition ships, Viking Octantis and Viking Polaris, we will see more than 12,000 people from all over the country visiting our Great Lakes. And what's exciting about this Viking partnership is it is really a heavy on the science side of things. So there's an official cooperative research agreement with NOAA in the Great Lakes and Viking Expedition that mandates both partners to really put science as a priority while these expeditions are happening, so that the passengers on Viking ships get to see a weather balloon. They don't get to see, they get to actually do the science. So they're releasing weather balloons, they're analyzing the data that comes back. They are working with scientists on board, NOAA scientists on board, to understand and analyze the water samples that are coming through the ferry box that's on board. So they're looking at microplastics, they're looking at acidification, they're looking at habitats. They've got amazing science capabilities on these ships. And I mentioned this is the second year, so we see so much potential with this partnership. And on top of the science part, they are stopping in Alpena directly. We're one of the main port stops. Last year, they stopped 9 times. This year, if you can believe it, they're going to stop 20 times. So literally in the middle of working with the team here to plan for those huge numbers of visitors coming to the visitor center and the sanctuary.
Well, I love that term you used, that sanctuary community. I thought that was great. And Admiral, to your point about like kind of bringing this all around to the blue economy, it's the science is amazing. The fact that you're growing the interest and understanding of maritime or underwater archaeology and the history and science is amazing. And from a maritime transportation background, I always think that that leads to a greater understanding of the maritime side of things and how that operates. And so people don't see it as this operation separate and apart from the science side of things. And I think the more we understand that system, that whole blue economy and all the pieces of it, the chances of making better decisions, I think, are there. And also just the fact that you're educating and informing so many young folks is just so admirable. I really appreciate that. Now, Russ, when you look at your area, and speaking of like, sanctuary community, you had mentioned just that like just from top to bottom of the sanctuary on the Wisconsin coastline. You've got so many activities and associated, whether it's just tourism activities or science activities. I'm guessing that your relationships are above and beyond just those things that are contiguous to the sanctuary, right?
Yeah, they are. And, you know, there's a pretty lengthy and robust public process to create a National Marine Sanctuary. And in the case of Wisconsin, we were one of the first, maybe the first, I don't know, we'll have to arm wrestle with Mallows Bay Marine Sanctuary over this, to begin with a community-based nomination. And so this is where, and this is the process as it stands today, that, you know, any community can look at the resources off their shores and make an argument for creating a National Marine Sanctuary there. And so the four communities in this stretch of the coastline got together and in partnership with the state of Wisconsin, submitted a nomination. So this idea of communities being at the very front end is baked into the way we manage the sanctuary right now. So, you know, I think our official process got started in about 2016. So that gave us a lot of time to work with communities, to get to know city leadership and nonprofits and others, you know, because community can mean a lot of different things. And so we developed those relationships over time. And I think that process is great because you hit the ground running. You know, once you've got the designation, you've already really created the relationships that are going to get the sanctuary off the ground really quickly. So it's not unusual for us to be visiting with mayors and city planners and others as we begin to think about our facility strategy, for example. You know, Stephanie talked about the visitor center in Alpena, and that's a big part of sanctuary. You know, Steph said it so well that, you know, this is how people are going to engage in the sanctuary and get value from it. And this is how we're going to be relevant, one of the ways. And so creating visitor experiences through this stretch of coastline with four communities is an interesting project for sure. It's different, I think, than some other models in sanctuaries. But Helen, it's one example of the way we're sort of working with communities. So that's not a top-down approach at all. That's we've had many focus groups with the communities to figure out what the right pieces for the sanctuary infrastructure-wise, you know, should look like in each of these communities.
We can't get away with you guys talking about some specific shipwrecks, of course. And for the Wisconsin side, I noticed that you have something called Wreck Wednesday. I thought it was very clever as an outreach piece, and that you talk about a different wreck each time. And recently you talked about a ship called the Alaska, which is only 5 feet of water, which is obviously something that people can see and get to. But of all the, Jesus, it's like asking you your favorite child, right? Of all of the shipwrecks that you have, Russ, and then also to Stephanie, like what are the ones that most fascinate people? Or is there a shipwreck out there that you really think is in the sanctuary, could be in the sanctuary, but is yet to be found?
Boy, that's a really good question. And I have three kids, so I'll say I love them all. So, you know, all of the shipwrecks are fantastic. I do have the worst answer to this question, which is I think the collection is what makes it so amazing to manage this place. But if I had to pick maybe a favorite that just hit or like ticked so many boxes, it would be the Rouse Simmons, which is a shipwreck here in the sanctuary off at Two Rivers, Wisconsin. And it's a great shipwreck itself. It's in about 160 feet of water. It's a schooner that was built in the 1860s, sank in 1912. So this long career. Folks may remember another shipwreck that occurred in 1912. That's the Titanic. So you're going from, you know, the frontier kind of period in Wisconsin all the way up to that industrial period. And this schooner is making its way and it's being adapted and sold and resold. Ultimately, it's owned in part by a man named Herman Schuneman, who grew up in Algoma, Wisconsin, tiny, tiny little town on the western frontier. And, you know, Herman is a second generation German immigrant. And eventually he makes his way to Chicago. He owns a number of businesses. Some go well, some don't, but he's really struggling to kind of to make his way in the world. He gets involved with shipping and he becomes a captain of the Rouse Simmons. And in its latest form and in its latest job, I guess, this schooner brought Christmas trees down from the UP. And of course, when you do this, you know, they got to be kind of fresh when you get there. So you're doing this in late November, early December. And they did this for several years. His brother, August Schuneman, actually died in a wreck while bringing Christmas trees down from Door County, Wisconsin. So Herman makes this fateful last voyage in November of 1912. And it's suspected that they're actually bringing the team of woodchoppers that are up there in the UP down to Chicago for this last trip of the season. And the ship disappears off of Two Rivers, Wisconsin. Life-saving station sees kind of a vague image of the shipwreck. They launch the of the ship going down. They launch a lifeboat. They don't see anything. And so this mystery from 1912 goes on until the 1960s. And so it's an amazing story because the Rouse Simmons was a fixture in Chicago at the Clark Street Bridge. There's still a memorial plaque there. And every year, Herman Schuneman would tie up this boat, and he had electric lights and the rigging. And so this was a real fixture in Chicago. But also, his wife and children keep this tradition going. And even that year, they bring Christmas trees down from the UP. Later, they use rail cars, but they keep this business going into the 1930s, which says a lot about the tradition in this maritime connection. What is so interesting, though, about the Rouse Simmons is that it continues to sail into the future, if you will. It was discovered by a wreck hunter in the late 1960s. And this is, again, in 160 feet of water, late 1960s, using kind of a route of entry sonar, finds the shipwreck on the bottom and does a dive on it solo. This guy's name is Kent Bell Richard, you know, in 160 feet of dark, cold Lake Michigan water in October. And so that discovery, and we could go on with the story, I'll stop, but it's so fascinating because that is an adventure in and of itself. And today we have the Wisconsin Maritime Museum just got a collection of 10,000 shipwreck artifacts, mostly from wrecks in the sanctuary, probably about 5,000 from the wreck of the Rouse Simmons. And so there's a whole nother legacy here that we'll be working with them to preserve and connect the public to. But long story short, every shipwreck sort of continues to sail into the future if we get really good about telling these stories.
Thank you. We did an episode on the Christmas Tree Ship of Chicago, which didn't, of course, really talk at all about discovery of the wreck. And that sounds like a really fascinating story of in itself. I probably have to revisit that. Stephanie, again, a hard question to ask. Is there a shipwreck that inspires you the most, or people are most interested in, or one that in particular you really feel like you'd like to find and haven't yet?
So I'm asking you if I could please have two answers to this question.
Absolutely.
Okay, good. Because I mentioned earlier, we just announced the discovery of a wooden schooner barge, the Ironton. And since this is such a recent published discovery, it's right now at the top of my mind, and it has such a compelling story. The Ironton sank in a collision in September of 1894. And we mentioned in the beginning, you were talking about this, Helen, how these shipwrecks, they do tell those tragic stories of the sailors and the captains and the crew, the women on board who tragically lost their lives. But it's also a window into the thousands and thousands of more people who worked and survived working and were a part of building up our American economy here on the Great Lakes. So it's really a window. And the Ironton tells that story so perfectly. So a very windy night, imagine this, late September, 1894, and the Ironton is a part of a fairly typical shipping configuration. It's being towed by the Kershaw, a steamer, and along with another schooner barge, the Moonlight. And so the Kershaw's steaming north, the Ironton and the Moonlight are behind it, attached with these tow lines, and they're both light, so they're both empty. And they're in their designated shipping lanes, just like you're on the interstate, busy traffic. And all of a sudden, the Kershaw loses power. Now, I mentioned it was a windy night, so that meant big waves. It was a clear night, but windy and lots of waves. So here we are, the Ironton and the Moonlight are now being towed by a vessel without power. Pretty dangerous situation. They decide to cut the tow lines, and the Kershaw continues on its way. The Ironton is trying to set sail to gain control of their vessel. At the same time, they're going off course into the southbound shipping lane
where a huge freighter, the Ohio, a wooden freighter full of 1,000 tons of grain is steaming south. You guessed what happens next. There's a collision. The Ohio sinks fairly quickly, and all 16 crew are able to get off onto the Moonlight, that other schooner barge. But the Ironton sort of sails off into the darkness. This was after midnight, and sank a bit later. The tragic part of the story is the seven crew, including the captain on board the Ironton, scrambling to get power, scrambling to get control, realizing with the gaping hole in their bow, they're not going to be able to head to their lifeboat. And they get in and they are trying to untie the painter, the line that connects the schooner barge to the lifeboat. But this vessel is starting to sink fast, and they hop in the lifeboat, get in it, and then they're not able to untie that line. Very tragic that five of the sailors go down with the Ironton. In fact, all seven started to go down, but two of them were able to pop up, and for the next 3 hours hung on to floating wreckage until they were picked up by another passing steamer, made it to another port, and were able to tell their survival story to the newspapers, and the headlines documenting the sinking of the Ironton are just so compelling because they go detail by detail. So that's 1894. It wasn't until 2019 that in a mapping project that we were talking about earlier with many partners, including Ocean Exploration Trust, led by Dr. Robert Ballard, that the Ironton was found using that high technology multi-beam sonar. So it's just a compelling story. And it hit the news on the 1st of March, and we were so thrilled to see the reaction around the world with this news story of the discovery. And I think a part of that was the just vivid, striking imagery that the underwater robot with its high-tech, high-resolution cameras was able to get of that lifeboat that's such a big part of the story, sitting there unused at the stern of the Ironton. So with that story and you know what it tells us about what it would be like to work on the Great Lakes in the 19th century, that's got to be one of my favorite. And if I have time, I have one more favorite, Helen.
Please.
Okay. My other favorite is a much shallower shipwreck, the Monahansett. We talk about the Monahansett being one of the stars of the sanctuary. And Tim, I had the pleasure of diving with Tim at the site of the Monahansett. It's in about 17 feet of water. And it really is a perfect maritime classroom, and also a perfect place for research and development. And it sits, like I mentioned, off Middle Island. So you've got this beautiful scenery there. You tie up the boat to the mooring buoy, and you're looking at Thunder Bay Island Lighthouse, and you're looking at the beautiful shoreline. And then you hop in, and it's that really looks like Caribbean blue, crystal clear water. And there you have the big steel propeller of the Monahansett. Thankfully, no lives were lost in the sinking of the Monahansett. It did sink in a storm and burned. Another long, great story about that one. But what's really exciting about the Monahansett goes back to the accessibility. So you can visit it on the glass bottom boat. You can visit it snorkeling or paddling. And like I mentioned, the people come from all over to test different technologies here in Thunder Bay. And so we've had, you know, it's been laser scanned, it has multi-beam, it has side scan, we've got photo models. So one of those great sites that's, it's really a star of the sanctuaries across the Great Lakes.
You talked about survival stories, and obviously a survival story is so important to understanding and making that the story of that ship more rich and certainly interesting. But then you can appreciate why, in the absence of a survival story, and maybe the Edmund Fitzgerald's a good example, in the absence of a survival story, getting down to see the ship, to understand the nature of the ship, what happened to the ship, is hugely important, certainly is for the Edmund Fitzgerald. And of course, because it wasn't that long ago, you still have family members who truly needed and wanted to know and understand. So, you know, the people, human side of this is just so huge. But thank you for sharing that. It's so, it just really, you get riveted listening to it. And so going to the sanctuary and seeing your displays and the history sounds fascinating. Can we talk a little bit about the diving side of this? And maybe I could start with Admiral Gallaudet and that, because I know you're an avid diver and see lots of photos of you in action. And as Stephanie said, you dove together on the Monohansett, which is fascinating. But what are the realities of diving on wrecks in a sanctuary? Not just the dangers of it. We do understand you should have a partner, and there's all kinds of basic diving etiquette and safety practices that come with the dive itself. But when you're in a sanctuary, what are the things to consider? And maybe, Admiral, we start with you and your experiences and go to Stephanie and then Russ.
Well, thank you, Helen. Stephanie and Russ are certainly the experts, and I'll let them actually answer the question. But let me make a plug here. When I was the acting and deputy administrator of NOAA, I did state I wanted to dive in every sanctuary. I got in a few, and one was with Stephanie, and Russ was topside during that dive, and it was such a wonderful day. And you're right, it was just an absolutely beautiful location too, Stephanie. But now I'm working with Force Blue. This is a veterans nonprofit that does ocean conservation to restore the health of the ocean and the health of these veterans, who many of which have post-traumatic stress. And we have just entered a partnership with NOAA's Office of National Marine Sanctuaries and the National Marine Sanctuary Foundation to deploy to every sanctuary and do a conservation mission. We've completed one in the Mallows Bay National Marine Sanctuary on the Potomac River. We did a eelgrass survey. I never thought I'd dive mallows, but here you go. We did. And we're aiming to get to the Great Lakes there, Russ and Stephanie, and even Lake Ontario if it gets stood up. So, but you could best answer the question about the best conservation measures to take when diving so as not to disturb the resources. Maybe you first, Russ?
Yeah, thanks, Tim. And we look forward to seeing you and Force Blue up here for sure. Man, we couldn't be more excited about trying to put that. Well, not trying. We will put that together. So we're really excited. You know, the diving, I think both Steph and I have been diving in the Great Lakes a little while now. And I guess I would just start by saying it probably sounds scarier than it is. Obviously, you should take this seriously and be well trained before you go out and do any kind of one of these adventure sort of activities. But you know, it's colder water. Sometimes a dry suit is the way to go. Often a dry suit is the way to go. In the late summer, at least in Wisconsin, in depths up to 60, 70 feet, you know, you still might be in the 60 degree water range, sometimes a little bit higher. So it still can be a comfortable dive with a thick wetsuit. Most folks do use a dry suit. The cool thing is, as Stephanie mentioned, is, you know, you can paddle out to some of these, right? So you can get your feet wet. You can snorkel, so you can get, you know, more of your body wet. You can do a beginning dive, and you can work all the way up to a 250 or 300 foot technical dive. So there's something for everyone here. So often people say, oh, geez, that seems really challenging. And it's not. There's an adventure that can be had by anyone. In terms of etiquette, we want people to visit these places. They're public resources, they're on public lands. And so we ask the public to visit these places responsibly. And we believe that educating the public, and as Stephanie said earlier, creating value so that you will protect what you love. And so if we can create the meaning and the value around these places, people will dive them responsibly. I've been working in the Great Lakes now 20 years in this sort of business, I guess, and I've really seen the ethic change in the way people view visiting shipwreck sites. So it's pretty simple. You know, you can't damage the wreck, you can't remove artifacts. And in the case of Wisconsin, we do have a regulation where you can't anchor directly into a shipwreck site. And that's new. That's a little bit different than Wisconsin. We actually put a 2-year delay on that. So in October of this year, it'll go into effect. And the idea was, you know, it's not a great idea to throw an anchor into a shipwreck site because it can create a lot of damage. However, we want people to visit these places. And so we're really pressing forward. And Tim, this might be a good one for Force Blue to install mooring buoys on each of these shipwreck sites so that no anchoring regulation doesn't prevent tourism and folks enjoying these places. So, you know, dive responsibly. Steph can maybe talk more about the safety aspect. She's an instructor. But I think from a resource protection standpoint, we want you to go to these places and bring back your own stories and your own imagery. Something we're really trying to pull together is a citizen science aspect to the sanctuary. So when folks go visit these places, you know, we'd love to see your photographs and your videos so we can create a long-term record of these places.
Thank you. Stephanie, I'd love you to talk a little bit more about how people can become more intimate with the sanctuary, even if they're not a super trained diver. And also, the waters of the Great Lakes aren't necessarily as clear, perhaps, or as deep, or if I just have that wrong.
You know, it's actually surprises a lot of people that dive around the world when they see pictures of the, we've said it a few times now, the crystal clear waters of the Great Lakes, and they truly are. And it might be because of an invasive species, the zebra and quagga mussels, but they have indeed cleared the water, filtered the water, and made the waters very, very clear. In fact, we'll be putting our mooring buoys out here in just about a month. And I remember years past sitting on the top of the boat, looking down at my dive buddies and being able to see their yellow tank at the site of the Grecian, which is 100 feet deep. So it's bright and clear, and especially those shallow ones. Of course, as you get to those deeper wrecks that Russ likes to dive 200 feet plus, it does get a little bit darker, a little bit colder. But there are so many different ways to experience it. And I'm glad you asked it that way. How can people connect with the sanctuary? And just tying into what Russ introduced about the citizen science, or that participatory science, a really valuable and needed way to connect with the sanctuary is sharing any documentation, visiting snorkelers, divers, even drone pilots might have of shipwrecks. We've mentioned the dozens of shipwrecks in Wisconsin and the 100 shipwrecks here. And with our charge of monitoring these shipwreck sites, it's pretty tough with a small staff. And so we really do rely on those groups like Forest Blue. How exciting to have such a group come and help document shipwreck sites, which is a big need, help put out those and install those mooring buoys that protect the sites. So a really powerful way to engage with the sanctuary is actually helping with the science for sure. And one of the taglines we love to say, very similar when you're hiking in the forest, take only pictures and leave only bubbles. So it's pretty manageable to responsibly visit these shipwreck sites. A last thing I'll say about engaging with this amazing cultural history we have in the Great Lakes is you don't have to get wet at all. You can stay at home and virtually dive these shipwrecks. And we're in partnership with our Office of National Marine Sanctuaries and their really high-tech filmmaking capabilities. We're just going to be producing more and more of those 360 video dive experiences where you can sit at home and dive a shipwreck in 3D and really enjoy a great experience.
Well, thank you. I'm so happy to hear that everybody has access to it in some way, shape, or form that's comfortable for them. Before we end, Russ, could you briefly tell us what's going on with the Lake Ontario Sanctuary Development?
Yeah, so it's been a little while, honestly, since I've been involved in that, but they just closed their public comment period on the proposed rule, which is a pretty big step. And this is basically lays out the boundaries and the regulations of what the sanctuary, what NOAA is thinking. That comes after a scoping period, so the public has already weighed in. I think that was about a year ago with some kind of general feedback on the concept of a sanctuary. So now we've moved to the next step. And so where the sanctuary folks will then take those public comments, look at the different alternatives, boundary alternatives, regulatory alternatives that they've proposed, and see what the public thinks about those, and then shape a final rule, which would then get published. You know, hard to say the timing on this kind of thing, but it's moved along pretty quickly. One of the really, I'm just looking right now, so the public comment period unfortunately ended March 20th, or we put a pitch out for that, but that's okay. You can still jump onto the Lake Ontario website. If you Google up Lake Ontario Marine Sanctuary, you'll find it, and you can get some information and provide your feedback even outside of the public comment period. That's super valuable, and we always take that into account as well. So that one is about 1,700 square miles. It's on the eastern end of Lake Ontario. So think about kind of the lower right-hand corner of Lake Ontario. That's the lake all the way to the right. If you're looking at the Great Lakes, there's about 40 shipwrecks there. And the interesting thing about this sanctuary is they're very, very early. So they span from the late 1700s. I'm not sure what the latest date is, but I'm sure they go into the early 20th century. So in terms of a continuity of a historical story, you know, Lake Ontario is early. Boy, that is really technology and shipbuilding skills and people are starting to move west, and that's all happening in eastern Lake Ontario first. And then Thunder Bay is a crossroads. Thunder Bay is like right at the center of the Great Lakes system. So if you're going to Lake Superior or Lake Michigan, you're coming by Thunder Bay. So Thunder Bay gets this really interesting cross-section of vessel types. And then Lake Michigan, you know, we have our own story. So historically, it completes a pretty neat picture. But, you know, the really exciting thing is, it's sort of like what Stephanie's talked about, and I've mentioned a little bit, it's just such a great opportunity to direct NOAA's mission of science and service stewardship into this area of Lake Michigan to do these things that go beyond conserving shipwrecks. And so it's an exciting proposal, and we really encourage folks to check it out.
Thank you. I love how you describe that basically NOAA is building a Great Lakes Maritime Underwater Archaeology Trail. So you can, you know, to lead it from the beginning. And I love that. So thank you to NOAA for all they're doing. So folks, we are kind of to the end of our show, and I hate to end because it seems like there's so much more to talk about. But Stephanie, to you and then to Russ and then to Tim. Stephanie, is there anything that you'd like to share before we close?
Oh, goodness. I would love to share an invitation to come to Alpena and connect with your National Marine Sanctuaries right here in the Great Lakes, and let us know when you're coming so we can give you a tour.
Wonderful. Thank you. I'm very excited about getting out there. Russ, how about you?
Boy, the same. Come out here and experience the sanctuary for yourself. You know, we're just getting off the ground, but there's great venues in each of these communities to experience history. And get a dive in or a snorkel or a paddle in. So you may not see a big NOAA logo on a building just yet in Wisconsin, but the wrecks are here. We're here. So reach out to us, and we'd love to help you plan a visit to come to this area of Wisconsin.
Thank you. Admiral, thanks so much for talking about Force Blue. It's really an extraordinary project, and I'm so grateful for your involvement in it. But generally, is there anything that you want our listeners to understand as they learn about sanctuaries in general or the Great Lakes sanctuaries?
Well, thanks, Helen. I just want them to understand what a great podcast host you are and what a great show the North Coast Chronicles is. I've enjoyed so many of them. The fishing one was terrific. The Christmas tree ship one was really enjoyable. I always love it when you bring your Laker captain brother on, so that's a great part of your show, too. And thanks for coming up with the idea to do this together. I'm delighted in every moment.
Thank you, Tim. I'm a huge fan of your show and of you, and I feel grateful that I had the opportunity to work with you directly. It was just fabulous. Thank you, all of you, for joining us. It was really terrific. This wraps up another episode of North Coast Chronicles, Tales from the Great Lakes. The creation and content for North Coast Chronicles is by me, Helen Broll, and co-produced and engineered by Tyler Buckingham of the American Shoreline Podcast Network. The sea shanty for our podcast was recorded by Catherine Chambers. Send me your comments, ideas for future podcasts, or to be a sponsor to northcoastchronicles@gmail.com. Join us next time on North Coast Chronicles as we continue our Great Lakes adventure. Until then, be good to one another.